without a spring or an itch. Pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. Call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Today, I thought that we would talk about obesity. A lot of increased interest has been noted just this last week, not only because obesity has been mentioned as a risk factor for COVID-19, but because of several interesting studies whose results were published recently. If you watch TV or listen to radio, you have probably heard the jingle for the medication called Ozempic. You should recognize it here.
Ozempic is helping many people with type 2 diabetes lower their blood sugar, and you may lose weight. Adults who took Ozempic lost on average up to 12 pounds.
In a phase 3 trial, where all participants received intensive behavior therapy, as well as weekly subcutaneous injections of 2.4 milligrams semaglutide, which actually resulted in a greater than 10% average weight loss than placebo over a period of 68 weeks.
It has not yet been approved for weight loss, but could be considered a potential major breakthrough in obesity management. The study was undertaken with 611 overweight adults with no diabetes. What's impressive is that 75% of those patients lost 10% or more of their body weight.
In diabetes, the injection is generally a 1 milligram weekly subcutaneous injection. Here, the dose has been increased to over twice the number of milligrams weekly.
Semaglutide is a glucagon-like peptide receptor agonist. Now, it doesn't matter what that means, but it's presently approved for treating type 2 diabetes. Because the large weight loss is noted, meaning 15 and 20% of initial weight are potentially a major breakthrough in the management of obesity, researchers, well, they stood up and took notice.
We know that obesity affects the heart among many other organs, and therefore losing weight should mean greater improvements in cardiometabolic risk factors like hypertension, sleep apnea, and type 2 diabetes.
At this point in time, behavioral and pharmacological treatments have only been successful to the tune of no more than 5 to 10%. The point really is that for most patients, there is really no satisfaction if the weight losses are lower than 10% of initial weight. Now, the larger categorical weight losses will mean that a greater number of patients with obesity will be able to achieve a weight loss with which they are, let's just say, happy.
So, it appears many of these patients will not even attempt to lose weight using any sort of weight loss plan unless they believe that the results will be higher than a 10% loss.
Is this an example of the saying, the dog wags the tail? Now, if you don't know what that saying means exactly, it really states that something small or not powerful is controlling something big or powerful. Now, people often use this expression to show a reversal of the normal role, a case when a component controls the whole. But an even better allegory, if that's even the correct term, is seen in a research paper titled, Are Poles and Probabilities Self-Fulfilling Prophecies? Now, in this paper, the authors state that psychologists have long observed that people conform to a majority opinion, a phenomenon sometimes referred to as the bandwagon effect. In the political domain, people learn about prevailing public opinion via polls, which may actually produce this effect.
So, polls and probabilities can become self-fulfilling prophecies, whereby majorities, whether in support of candidates or policies, grow in a cascading manner.
Just as polls can influence a reader's decision on who to vote for, so can research help create a successful product. Remember the pet rock? And according to Louis J. Aron, MD, a wild professor of metabolic research, semaglutide is really going to be a major advance in the treatment of obesity. Now, a question was put forth to the researcher asking what would happen if a patient stopped taking the drug.
Dr. Aron stated that it may be that taking medicine, any medicine for chronic overweight, may become like taking a statin for elevated cholesterol, meaning that it will need to be taken on a continual basis.
Dr. Scott Kahan, A physician said that the data confirming that semaglutide, particularly when used in concert with evidence-based counseling, is a highly effective agent for obesity management. That's impressive. The question is now, will semaglutide be approved by the U.S. FDA, the Food and Drug Administration? One question, of course, will be the cost to the patient. And that means that we have to consider if there will be insurance coverage.
Remember that even with all the talk about COVID-19 vaccines and the media coverage of the supposed efficacy of the new vaccine, there is still a less than 40% agreement of the U.S. population to receive the vaccine in the near future.
Just like the statement, you can't win the lottery if you don't play, you need to take action to receive the benefits or the risks. For example, many drugs shown to be beneficial, like the statins, will only become massively used when they go generic.
One of the benefits of semaglutide is its side effect list. It is apparently well tolerated, with gastrointestinal adverse events being the most common problem.
Now, this did occur in a whopping 83% of patients in the semaglutide group, but it also occurred in 63% of patients in the placebo group. Nausea and vomiting, diarrhea were common, but these are common in past medications that increased the GLP-1 levels. It's also shown that these side effects can be controlled by slowly increasing the medication dose over a period of 4 months. In other words, start low and go slow. Now, we only talked about the injectable form of semaglutide.
There is an oral form called Rybelsus, made by the Novo Nordisk company, in doses of 7 milligrams and 40 milligrams to improve glycemic control along with diet and exercise. It is also the first GLP-1 agonist available in tablet form.
While researching that story, I came across another sort of related article that was titled, Coca-Cola Contracts Allow Research to Be Suppressed. This actually comes from a 2019 report, but I found it interesting.
Apparently, sometimes what appears to be the good works of a company and in the public interest turns out to put the company in a bad light.
Wording in 5 contracts for Coca-Cola funding of health research at 4 North American universities would have allowed the company to quash studies. Although this never actually happened, according to a new report, the unrestricted funding contracts had restrictive clauses. The information was brought to the public by a Freedom of Information request by the nonprofit consumer and public health research group, U.S. Right to Know.
The authors aimed to really see if a Coca-Cola contract reflected the company's true intention to be transparent in their health research funding, as was implicitly stated on their website.
In 2015, it was revealed that Coca-Cola Company funded a global energy balance network to divert attention from the role that sugar-sweetened beverages play in the obesity epidemic by excessively emphasizing the role of lack of exercise. Soon after that, the Global Energy Balance Network was shut down.
We all know, at least from what we have heard in the media, that vaccines typically require years of research and testing before reaching the clinic. But Operation Warp Speed was initiated to change that for this COVID-19 epidemic, and apparently it has worked.
Researchers are now testing at least 54 different vaccines in clinical trials on humans, and at least 87 preclinical vaccines are under active investigation in animals. Work began in January with the deciphering of the SARS-CoV-2 genome. The first vaccine safety trials in humans started in March, and now 12 have actually reached the final stages of testing. Now, some of these trials will most likely fail, maybe not, but others may end without a clear result.
But a few vaccines may succeed in stimulating the immune system to produce effective antibodies against the virus.
It's important to know that vaccines are not used to treat those who have the virus. It's not going to change the symptoms, nor the severity, nor the mortality of those who have already contracted the disease. It is strictly a preventative, just like the measles and the polio virus vaccines.
In a nutshell, it is how testing works. It is done in phases, including preclinical testing, where scientists first test a new vaccine on cells and then give it to animals such as mice or monkeys to see if it produces an immune response.
Then, in what's called phase 1, the safety of the vaccine is tested. It doesn't matter how efficacious the vaccine is if it causes worse results. As the saying goes, The surgery was a success, but the patient died. In these safety trials, scientists give the vaccine to a small number of people to test safety and dosage, as well as to confirm that it stimulates the immune system.
This is why the starting point is often another vaccine that has been used in the past, since its safety has already been proven.
Then come the expanded trials, also called Phase 2. Here, the scientists give the vaccine to hundreds of people, split into groups such as children and the elderly, to see if the vaccine acts differently in them. Now, these trials further test the vaccine's safety and ability to stimulate the immune system.
Phase 3 is the next step, and what most people think is the final phase. These are the efficacy trials where the vaccine is given to thousands of people. Then they wait to see how many become infected compared with volunteers who received a placebo.
So at this point, we are really testing to see if, in this pandemic, the vaccine protects against the coronavirus that causes the disease we now call COVID-19. The FDA advised vaccine makers that they would want to see evidence that vaccines can protect at least 50% of those who receive it. Then come the regulators. In each country, the trial results are reviewed and decide whether to approve the vaccine or not.
It is during this period, during a pandemic, that a vaccine may receive emergency use authorization before getting formal approval.
There is one way to accelerate vaccine development, and that is to combine phases. We've just been talking generally concerning the coronavirus vaccines. Now let's talk turkey. And I don't mean Thanksgiving. Let's look at the two most recent successes that have been on the top of the news for the past weeks. These being the vaccines made by Pfizer and Moderna.
Two vaccine candidates using similar technology are winning the COVID-19 vaccine race in the U.S. and in the process validating the mRNA platform, which is yet untested on the market.
Pfizer and BioNTech have the highest efficacy ratings at around 90%, maybe 95%, much higher than the 60% bar that was really set by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and surpassing the minimum number of infections required in order to conclude the trial. Moderna recently boasted an even higher efficacy rate.
So, what advantages does the Moderna vaccine have? Well, it doesn't need the low temperatures that the Pfizer products need in shipment and storage.
Moderna also said that zero severe COVID-19 cases were reported in the vaccinated group, which gives the company an even bigger boost. Both companies have had to retrofit their plants to produce the necessary doses. Pfizer's vice president of distribution said that they purchased hundreds of ultra-cold freezers to hold the vaccines as it ramps up production. And he said, well, if we overboard on freezers, we overbought.
Pfizer has opted to directly ship its vaccine to points of use, while Moderna will rely on the federal government's contract with McKesson.
Pfizer's CEO has been keen to highlight the company's independence from federal funding, though it is a part of Operation Warp Speed as it relates to the government purchasing the vaccines, as well as supplying vials and other supplemental equipment. Pfizer also revealed its vaccine proved especially efficacious with the 65 and older population, which makes it, well, maybe the prime candidate for nursing homes.
But there are things that we still do not know about the vaccine. For example, does it impart permanent immunity? Will we need to get an immunization every year or even more often? The next question is who or what groups will be the first to be offered to receive the vaccine?
Remember that the elderly and children require the most attention as vaccine doses can affect them more dramatically than healthy adults.
Remember that both the front runners require two shots to provide adequate protection. What happens if the individual receiving the first shot forgets to get the booster, or what if they get the other company's booster?
The answer to these questions are still unknown. And let's get back to the economics. Obviously, someone pays for all this research and development and for the purchase of the vaccines, including the profits that the manufacturers will make from the sale and the administration of the vaccines to everyone.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center.
I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 33 years.
We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday.
If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
Now that we have covered the topic of prevention of COVID-19, we're going to step into the realm of treatment.
COVID-19 pandemic is one of the greatest challenges modern medicine has ever faced. Doctors and scientists are scrambling to find treatments and drugs that can save the lives of infected people and perhaps even prevent them from getting sick in the first place.
Every week we've tried to bring you the latest updates on treatments. Sometimes 1 week's suggestions are the next week's failures. So we're still looking at least 22 different proposed potential coronavirus treatments for effectiveness and safety. First, we have a long list of treatments. We can start with the products that have shown promising evidence in animals and humans. One of these is Remdesivir, made by the Gilead Sciences Company.
The brand name of this product is Veklury. It was actually the first drug to gain approval from the FDA for the treatment of COVID-19. It works by interfering with the creation of new viruses by inserting itself into new viral genes.
Remember when we said that it's faster to try older tested vaccines before trying new ones, since the safety factors help lower the time that the vaccines are in the testing phases? Well, the same thing goes for the treatments.
Remdesivir was originally tested as antiviral against Ebola and hepatitis C. It was safe but did not have very good results. But a randomized controlled trial published in May concluded the drug reduced recovery time of people hospitalized with COVID-19 from 15 to 11 days.
So the FDA responded to this information and issued an emergency authorization for remdesivir's use in critically ill patients who needed supplemental oxygen.
Then 3 months later, they expanded the approval after researchers found that patients with less severe forms of COVID-19 seemed to benefit modestly from a 5-day treatment course of remdesivir.
That approval allows the use of the drug on all patients hospitalized with COVID-19, regardless of how severe their disease is. But the move was criticized by some experts who said the FDA had expanded remdesivir's use without strong evidence to back the change. Just 2 months later, on October 3rd, doctors treating President Trump said that he had begun a 5-day course of intravenous remdesivir, and on October 22nd, the FDA gave full approval to the drug for use in patients 12 years and older.
But even with approval, it remains to be seen how useful remdesivir is as a treatment against COVID-19.
Recently, the World Health Organization released the results of the largest randomized clinical trials on remdesivir so far. Their study showed no evidence of reducing mortality, keeping patients off ventilators, or even shortening their stay in the hospital. Now, while some experts were critical of how the study was designed, most agreed that remdesivir might perform best in patients who are earlier in their disease course. Nevertheless, Gilead scientists said that remdesivir had brought in $873 million in revenues to the company for this year.
There are several others whose names all seem to rhyme with remdesivir. These include favipiravir and molnupiravir.
Now, unlike remdesivir, which has to be given intravenously, molnupiravir can be swallowed as a pill. Remember that in weeks past, we talked about a treatment that involved ACE2. That's because in order to enter cells, the coronavirus must first unlock them, a feat it accomplishes using latching onto a human protein called ACE2. So the scientists have actually created artificial ACE2 proteins, which might be able to act as what they call decoys, luring the coronavirus away from vulnerable cells. Now, that idea has been promising, but not yet has it been used on animals or people. Well, have you heard of ivermectin?
For the case, this medication has served as a potent drug to treat parasitic worms. It is given not only to humans, but to dogs as well.
Scientists have yet to find evidence in animal studies or even human trials that it can treat viral diseases. And as a result, ivermectin is still not approved to use as an antiviral.
Even so, some researchers serendipitously reported that the drug blocked coronaviruses in cell cultures. They used a dosage that was so high it might have dangerous side effects in people, so the FDA had to immediately issue a warning against taking pet medications to treat or prevent COVID-19.
Nevertheless, ivermectin is being prescribed increasingly often in Latin America. Have you ever heard or seen an oleander bush? It's beautiful. and it does grow in our area. It has perfumed flowers, but, and again, this is a big but, the oleander branches are toxic, and if you try to compost the clippings, well, let's just say it's quite toxic.
It is a member of the dogbane family, and that in itself sounds ominous. It contains poisons, including cardiotonic glycoside, prussic acid, and gluten that can cause nausea, heart attack, and death.
A person who eats the seeds, leaves, or stem pieces can literally die within hours, and the same applies to dogs, horses, and cows. Even touching the plant results in skin irritation or possibly dermatitis in those who are sensitive. It is, in fact, one of the most poisonous plants known, with all parts of the plant being toxic. An ingestion of just one leaf can cause heart attack and death.
Oleandrin is a compound produced by the oleander shrub. It can cause irregular heartbeats, making the plant dangerous to ingest. But many plant compounds, even some potentially lethal ones, have proven to be medically useful. And some researchers have investigated oleandrin as a potential treatment for cancer.
The U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases tested oleandrin on coronavirus-infected cells in May, but the experiments were deemed inconclusive. So stay away from oleander.
There are quite a few more chemicals and medications that have been suggested, such as lopinavir and ritonavir, which 20 years ago were approved in combination to treat HIV.
Recently, researchers tried them out on the new coronavirus and found that they stopped the virus from replicating, but the clinical trials in patients has just proven disappointing. Well, how about hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine? The on-again, off-again treatment that has been touted by many to be very successful.
German chemists synthesized chloroquine in the 1930s as a drug against malaria. The less toxic version, called hydroxychloroquine, was invented in 1946 and later was approved for other diseases such as lupus and rheumatoid arthritis.
A few small studies on patients offered some hope that hydroxychloroquine could treat COVID-19. President Trump repeatedly promoted hydroxychloroquine at press conferences, touting it as a game changer, and even took it himself. In fact, the FDA temporarily granted hydroxychloroquine emergency authorization for use in COVID-19 patients. But more detailed studies proved disappointing. Studies on animals such as monkeys and mice found no evidence that hydroxychloroquine stopped the disease.
Even randomized clinical trials found that hydroxychloroquine didn't help people with COVID-19 get better or prevent healthy people from contracting the coronavirus, and the ADA revoked its emergency approval.
The FDA now warns that the drug can cause a host of serious side effects to the heart and other organs when used to treat COVID-19. But that was not the end of it. In July, researchers at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit published a study finding that hydroxychloroquine was associated with a reduction in mortality in COVID-19 patients. Again, President Trump praised the study on Twitter, but experts raised doubts about it. There are still hydroxychloroquine studies being done today.
Some treatments mimic the immune system, and we haven't really scratched the surface of the treatments that have been tried, both successfully and unsuccessfully.
Now, we could just drop the subject and do something else next week. But we think that with the surge in cases, not only in the U.S. but across the world, and the effect it's having on both our economies as well as our personal and social lives, we should go on explaining the rest of the treatments that are still up in the air. And as one famous radio announcer named Paul Harvey used to say, stay tuned next week for the rest of the story.
I would like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area who has received the state certification to recommend medical marijuana to Florida residents for certain qualifying conditions.
These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
I would also like to welcome Dr. Susan Pollan, MD, a board-certified pain management physician who will care for all of your pain-related problems, including chronic and long-term pain. Welcome, Dr. Pollan.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.